The Senate Committee on Human Services and Rural Health Policy will come to order, please. Welcome on this beautiful, it was sunny on Friday, on this beautiful sunny post-Friday day. Okay, we're going to start with Senate Bill 146. We have a work session on Senate Bill 146. I'll open the work session.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 146.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 146. Discussion. Tell us what the Dash 1 amendments do.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Dash 1 amendments provide a definition of the word premises. And basically, as defined in Senate Bill 146-1, premises does not include a client's residence.
And Mr. Chair,
yes.
And I think it's important to know that there are some people that are still unhappy with the bill as it is, and I think we as a committee just have to come forward and say this is the best decision that we think and should go forward.
I agree. Okay. No objections to Dash 1. So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 146 as amended by the Dash 1 amendment to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves 146 as amended by the Dash 1 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Would you call discussion? Further discussion? Would you call the roll, please?
Aye.
Aye.
No.
Aye.
Chair Morrison.
Aye. Okay, the Senate Bill 146 passes. Senator Cruz, would you like to carry this bill?
Okay.
Okay, Senator Cruz, we'll carry the bill. Okay, we're carrying one Senate Bill 185 over 158 over until a later time. Okay, Senate Bill 649. We will open the public hearing. Do we have a sign up sheet? Ashlyn, would you come up, please? Jonathan, Ian, would you also come up?
You're not going to describe the bill or anything?
Go ahead and discuss.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 649 requires drug manufacturers and wholesale drug outlets to adopt a marketing code of conduct, provide and conduct training, and perform an annual audit and report the information to the State Board of Pharmacy on an annual basis. The board then will report those findings back by March 31st of every regularly scheduled legislative session.
Okay. Introduce yourself, please.
Great. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ashlyn Anderson, and I'm here on behalf of the Consumer Healthcare Products Association. CHPA represents the nation's leading manufacturers of over-the-counter medicines and nutritional supplements, and I'm happy to be back before your committee. CHPA has a couple of concerns about this measure and similar measures that we've seen in other states. I'll try to keep it brief. The first point is that we think the scope is a little bit overly broad, the way that the terms are defined in the measure. Mm-hmm. And secondly, that the penalties are disproportionate to what the violation or offenses might be. To the first point about overly broad, similar to the bill I testified on last week, the way drug is defined in this bill includes over-the-counter medicines, including things like medicated lip balms and toothpaste and things like that. CHPA doesn't think that the intention of this bill was to create regulatory requirements for companies that only produce things of that nature. We think that the intention was for communications with healthcare providers, things like that. But it would include marketing companies that market with no provider interaction. So, for example, a company whose only marketing is directly to retailers. And this creates an additional regulatory burden that companies that only market to retailers aren't used to having to deal with the Board of Pharmacy and developing a marketing code and things of that nature. Also, CHPA already has a voluntary advertising code that protects consumers themselves. There's no need for an additional regulatory compliance component for that. And then secondly, in terms of the disproportionate penalties, in this chapter, there are penalties that are pretty severe. It can be a fine up to $10,000 per violation per day. And also, there are criminal penalties. There could be a misdemeanor for failure to report under the chapter. These penalties are designed for things like practicing pharmacy without a license. So they're very appropriate in that situation, but we don't feel that they're appropriate for something like noncompliance with a marketing code of conduct. So simply for those two reasons, because we think the definitions are overly broad and the penalties are disproportionate to the offense, CHPA has to oppose this measure.
Okay, thank you. Questions?
Thank you.
Jim Gardner.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, apologize for being late. Got caught in a little traffic. But Jim Gardner, representing Pharma, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, and Mr. Chair and members of the committee, as you know, we've dealt with these issues, pharma marketing, disclosure, various prohibitions over the years and over recent sessions. We actually furnished the chair with the language that is in this bill. It's based on the Nevada statute, and it is what we call the attestation approach. I would agree that the existing guidelines, the voluntary pharma code, which, Mr. Chair, you're familiar with, and the OIG guidelines from HHS, which apply to anybody that's doing, any manufacturer that's doing business with Medicare and Medicaid, are sufficient. They're sufficient to prevent any untoward, inappropriate conduct. However, that being said, of all of the various marketing restrictions, marketing disclosure bills that are floating out there, primarily on the House side, we view this as the least onerous, most workable, and probably the one with the lowest fiscal. Mr. Chair, that's about all I have to say.
Well, I don't know how you define lowest. That's... But we'll get to that later. Questions of Mr. Gardner? Seeing no questions, okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jonathan Eames. I'm from PacWest Communications here on behalf of Genentech. And Genentech strongly supports Senate Bill 649. As Mr. Gardner mentioned, there are strong federal guidelines which outline the process by which a drug company, can remunerate a doctor for bona fide third-party transactions. Genentech has a very strong and very vital fraud unit in their company, and this laws like this, which are based on the Nevada statute only strengthen what Genentech is currently doing. While Genentech is not a member of PhRMA, they do follow the PhRMA Code of Interactions and Healthcare Professionals as a floor. They often exceed what is required in the PhRMA Code of Conduct, and bills such as this only strengthen the work that Genentech is already doing, and we'd love to see this in this state and others as we move forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Senator Cruz.
I am probably concerned that the language is overly broad, but and anybody can answer this, because there are already rules and codes in place. Isn't this a solution in search of a problem to a large degree?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, let me figure out how to answer that. In a sense, it is, because as I testified earlier, we think that the existing code, and particularly the OIG guidelines, which are mandatory for anybody doing business with Medicare or Medicaid, are very strong and very... But that being said, if there is a necessity for a bill to be passed, of the bills that are out there, this one is by far, we think, the most workable.
Follow up?
Yes.
If you could provide the committee with the OIG guidelines and the PhRMA Code of Conduct, just to inform us of what currently exists, there's very few... I mean, I'm trying to think of who out there in the pharmaceutical world does not deal with Medicare and Medicaid, and I think the answer to that is zero. So, if there are already strong federal guidelines, I'm not sure why we need to go beyond that. But if we had those guidelines and code of conduct, I think it would help inform us here.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, I'll be delighted to furnish copies of both to the committee.
Okay, thank you. Senator Tuck.
No, go ahead.
No, I didn't know you had. No, you go ahead.
A question, just in clarification on something in the bill, an annual audit, and I don't know if you have the answer or if maybe the bill has the answer. We are talking about CPA-level financial examination.
That was not my intent.
Mr. Chair, Senator Telfer, I don't believe that's the a full kind of CPA type of audit. I don't believe that's the intent, but maybe that could be clarified.
Follow up?
Yes.
Just because as a CPA, audit means something specific, and so when I see the term audit, I always need to know what we're talking about when we say audit, so we might want to clarify that.
Okay. Senator Mona Sanderson.
I guess I need to get a handle on the intent of this bill. Is every pharmaceutical wants their drug to be marketed in the best possible way, and there's lots of different forms to do that, including, and I want to focus on how we market with the Department of Human Services, say for immunizations. Would this affect that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson, I don't think that's the intent of the bill.
Okay.
Immunization education and outreach for state programs. I don't think that's the intent of the bill.
Let me clarify the intent of the bill. We passed a code of ethics for legislators in terms of amounts of money that we could accept for various junkets, so to speak, going for weekends and to meetings and being wined and dined and playing golf and so on. I felt that the pharmaceutical industry should be held to various standards of compliance. I searched the internet and found programs that I thought were fairly complete. State of Vermont, for instance, has a program. But in looking at the cost, I knew that it would not go anywhere. I mean, it simply wouldn't fly. And so my conversation with the industry was there was a code of ethics that we could adopt as in statute to reinforce the federal guidelines and so on. So I felt that it would be important to define this in statute to show that we were concerned about the problem. Now, knowing that there are other bills that do have a fiscal, I felt that, you know, this would be better than nothing. I'm not happy with the... I think this would have a large fiscal the way it's written. And we're going to have to take a look at that. But I do feel that we should make a statement about the pharmaceutical industry, not that they're trying to do something, or they are doing anything wrong, but to hold, in statutorily, to hold them responsible. Enforcement of law, you don't have a policeman on every corner to make sure everybody stops at the stop sign, but when you do catch them, there is a penalty. And that's kind of the way this enforcement is. I don't know that there, if there is an audit, it would be a minimal audit, and I don't intend, I'm hoping that we can pass something without a fiscal this time. We could always add to it at a later date. I don't think the House bills are going to go anywhere based on the cost. So that was my intent. Other questions, comments?
And Mr. Chair, we'll get those documents to
okay.
the committee.
Good. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Since the State Board of Pharmacy is the one who take who is going to speak for the State Board of Pharmacy? Anyone?
I don't. No. State
okay.
Board of Pharmacy is shaking their head no.
Okay.
Okay. With that, we will close the public hearing. And his representative.
No, a bit early. 15 minutes, I guess.
Okay.
Before he's here.
Okay. We'll do 702. We're going to open public hearings on Senate Bill 550, 551, 552. We're going to open a public hearing on each of those bills. 550, 551, 552. James, would you come up, please? Nicole, would you? Okay. I want you to respond. This is a public hearing on these bills to determine whether or not we need to move any or all of them. There seems to be some confusion here, but we need to have a discussion of these three bills. Okay. Nicole, would you like to start?
Sure. Chair Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nicole Armstrong. I'm here on behalf of O4AD, the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. The three bills, 550, 551, and 552, were bills that we introduced, and I'll just briefly go over them. We do have some amendments back. The amendments to 550 are sort of okay, but 551 and 552 still have a lot of problems with them. So, unfortunately, what we got back doesn't address everything we need to
okay.
do in the bills yet.
Okay.
So, I'll just tell you briefly what we're trying to get at, but we need to go back to LC and
okay, talk to
have that
let's
again.
Talk at 550.
Senate Bill 550 is, our intent was to have a regular reporting to the legislature about the savings that are realized in the utilization of home and community-based care. Originally, what we were also asking for was to be able to try to quantify people who are Medicaid eligible but perhaps choose lesser expensive forms of care such as Oregon Project Independence, which is not something that's regularly reported right now. And that's a number that we're interested in, and people that could be here but choose this, thus saving the state money and quantifying that to be able to report that out to the legislature. The bill does not address that. It also doesn't quite get to long-term care in the text of the bill, but that's what we were looking at.
Okay. Any comments on 550?
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, I'm Deanna Hartwig, the Administrator of the Office of Federal Resource and Financial Eligibility, Seniors and People with Disabilities, Department of Human Services. I think Nicole's further explanation of 550 and the additional amendments that were coming would change what I had planned to testify on today. In terms of the other two, three bills, we are waiting for those amendments as well so we can give them a thorough analysis.
I guess I'm wondering if we need to do any of these three bills, and that's kind of what I'm wanted to have a discussion about. We can bring them back or not bring them back, but can the department do what these bills are asking of you? I know you can. Would you?
Mr. Chairman, most of the savings that occur in all of our caseloads, we put together detailed analyses and cost figures around that already as part of our regular rebalance plan. If we were to pull those out and do some kind of separate report, I don't think that's problematic at all, and we could certainly do that even without requiring legislation. But if that's what the legislature and the stakeholders would like, we could certainly do that.
Well, I don't want to require legislation if we don't need legislation, and I think that you have a good track record of doing what within fiscal you say you would like to do. I know that there are times when money is moved and that doesn't allow you to pursue a problem, but I mean these to me look like, most of them look like you're gathering information and reporting back to the legislature.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. Go ahead.
No, Mr. Chairman, I think, I don't want to speak for Nicole, but I think the frustration sometimes of the stakeholders is the department's budget is enormous and very complex, and there's just an enormous amount of detail. And within that detail is always all of the cost assumptions on all of the caseloads as they move back and forth and where there's savings and where there's deficits, et cetera. But if we can be more transparent and sort of call that out separately so folks have a thorough understanding of that, we can certainly do that.
Would you identify yourself, please?
I'm sorry. James Taves, Seniors and People with Disabilities, Department of Human Services.
Okay. Yes, Senator Bridges.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to just kind of take it from the legislator's point of view and as a member of the Four Ways and Means. I find it very difficult in making a decision if there is a budget recommendation that I don't have some comparison to what might happen and impact. In other words, if there is a less expensive way of serving people, that's the way we want to go, particularly in these times. And so it looks to me like these bills are trying to get at firming up whether you're making a good decision in cutting these services to people if in fact, it's cheaper the way we're doing it now than the way it's been suggested. Does that make sense? So I think the information is critical. So whether you need legislation or whether you don't, I think for the people that are making decisions on your budget, they really need to have all of that kind of comparison data so that they can make a wise decision. Whether it's losing federal funds or whether it's keeping people in their home with OPI rather than them moving out and moving into nursing facilities, all these things are critical in making the decision. So that's what it looks to me like these three bills are trying to get at, is firming up with the agency that those numbers are known and that is a part of the discussion. So, Nicole, you might want to tell me if I'm wrong, but that's just what, in looking at them, what that means.
Chair Morissette, Senator Verger, that is what we're trying to get at with 550, is that comparison of the choices people make. And I know that's a hard one to quantify, and we haven't quite got to it yet a little bit in what the language is. But certainly if there's a way that the department is able to provide that kind of comparative information to the legislative body without legislation, we're happy to have that. But what we see from our side of the fence through the case managers working one-on-one with the clients is when somebody makes those decisions and what the options are and what the capacity is. And I think that's part of the conversation that Ways and Means is not always able to have without, but it is a lot of information. It takes a lot of looking at a lot of different kinds of pieces of it to see all of those working parts, all the hydraulics of it. And that's kind of what we were getting at. Senate Bill 551 and 552 are just a little bit different, and I'd be happy to speak to those if that's okay at the moment. Senate Bill 551 and 552, we like to call our worst case scenario. These bills, we hope we don't have to use this session, but we wanted to make sure to have something in place in the event that there are seniors and people with physical disabilities that lose services due to cuts this session. And what the bills are speaking to is, first of all, looking at a way to transition people if they are going to have to leave services. How do you do that in the most humane way possible, and how is there a way to provide some sort of support as they're leaving the system to make sure that they can survive this kind of transition? Some of the recommendations in the governor's budget were extremely egregious, would really be quite detrimental, damaging, and potentially life-threatening to seniors and people with disabilities at very high impairment levels, and how do you help them make that transition? It's not as simple as sending them a letter and saying, you're out, what do you do? And we wanted to have at least some sort of piece in place to have a conversation about how that happens, as well as a way to look at what happens to people once they do leave services. I think one of the questions that we from the area agencies have received the most in the last 6 months is, what happened to the people in 01 and 03 who lost services? What happened to them? Where did they go? Did they wind up costing the state more money? We can only answer that on an anecdotal level. There wasn't anything in place to do any sort of a slice study or of people and what happened to them. We can't tell you that. We can only tell you on an anecdotal level. We can't tell you in a quantifiable way because we didn't necessarily have the ways or the money to follow that. And so our goal in these two is also to provide a mechanism to study what happens to people when they lose services, and to use that kind of information, which I think is extremely important to when we come back in the next and the subsequent sessions to make recommendations on how we begin to put things back together. And that's the information we didn't have in 0103.
Senator Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know with health care reform, we're spending a lot of time on some bills that deal with data collection. In fact, there's federal stimulus money to help us get some of this, of these things ready if we as a legislature decide to go that route. And I'm not sure that senior and people with disabilities could take advantage of that, but I don't think it would hurt to pass this with health care reform, getting that into Ways and Means for the possibility that we could use monies that are going to be a part of the health care reform package that we're trying to send through in my committee. Can you respond to how that can relate to federal stimulus money and the recommendations that the Oregon Health Fund Board has put forward? Because I certainly wouldn't want us, I would want us to be in a coordinated effort here.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Mona Sanderson, I know we're organizing within the department to respond to the whole electronic health record, and there are stimulus dollars directed at that. We have never been able to fully integrate the records on both the acute care side and the long-term care side, and there's been lots of issues and concerns around HIPAA and other things in terms of how that information moves back and forth. So I'm not sure, and Deanna, if you can help me if you know any more about this, that the electronic health record will really help us track people on the long-term care side. It probably will on the acute care side, but I'm not sure on the long-term care side. And I think what Nicole is referring to are people that have been in service, have left service because of budget cuts or other reasons, and where they go.
Well, I know, follow up.
Go ahead.
I know that Medicare is sort of screwing us over, in a sense, with the fact that we do such a good job in keeping people out of the nursing care homes, and having the long-term care system that we have with in-home services and foster care and assisted living. So to me, if we had this information, it could at least make a better case to the feds, and that's why I sort of see some nexus between, since we're dealing with Medicare dollars in some sense, maybe not all, but to get a nexus between with healthcare reform and what the Oregon Health Fund Board is doing. And it's a problem at the federal level, definitely, but I'm just trying to see some coordination here.
Go ahead.
Chair Morissette, Senator Monis Anderson, I would be happy to talk to the people who are moving with 2009 to see if there's a way maybe we could coordinate or integrate with that. It's not something that we've looked at because 2009 has a lot to do with the acute care system, but certainly could ask that question before moving these.
It would be more in talking with Dr. Smith and Carol Robertson regarding our concerns, because we do have silos in this state. It'd be nice to get some coordination. Thank you.
Okay. During the 08 session, we passed an omnibus bill that asked the department to come back with information. And I think that you did come back with information. Now, the question is, do we want to pass an omnibus bill this time? Do we want to integrate these into a single bill? Do we want to do separate bills? Do we want to do any bills that ask you to do this? I think it's extremely important that we understand, you know, we know where people have fallen off the table, too. For instance, Project Independence is zeroed out this time. That will leave a huge gap in assistance at the most cost-effective level. In preparation for bringing people back into the service at some point, this would be very helpful. And I think what Senator Verger said, that it would be vitally important to the Ways and Means Committee to understand the most cost-effective ways to serve people. In fact, that's one of the watchwords, is cost avoidance. How do we avoid further cost? We fund the most effective programs at the lowest cost. And so that kind of information is important. It's kind of frustrating, though, because this time we're having problems getting amendments, and this is kind of a hard area to nail down exactly what we mean and exactly what we're asking the department to do. I think we're asking you to do things, but are these things that you would do anyway? And if not, should we direct you to do them? That might help you to get the resources to do the things that you would like to do if we put it in the statutory language. But I'm trying to figure out what the best way is to work with these three bills that we've been bouncing around for the last 6 weeks. James, would you?
Mr. Chairman, part of the issue, particularly with tracking people who have left the system because of budget cuts or other reasons, is in our entire field structure, we are many hundreds of positions short of an actual caseload or workload standard. We simply haven't kept pace with the growth. So our case managers and eligibility workers and others in the field are so overwhelmed at this point, they barely keep up with people coming to the front door. So we don't do we hardly do a job at all of tracking people that go out the back door and leave our system, although we found in 2001 and 3 when we cut a lot of people from service, we actually a couple times took snapshots of the people who then came back into the system, often with more expensive services because they had sort of lost the few things that sort of kept their lives together. And we even tried at that time to do a major study through a grant with Portland State to do sort of a formal analysis of what happens to people, but we didn't end up getting that funded. But I mean, we need a lot more capacity, really, to track what happens to people, because it helps us plan and predict future services as well. But again, our current information systems and our caseload capacity in the field, I think, doesn't sustain that.
Okay. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, based on the conversation I'm hearing, I'm a little concerned about the fiscal impact statement then, because it basically says in the last paragraph that everybody in the department is doing this already, and it's just a coordinated effort. So I think the fiscal impact statement is incorrect if what I'm hearing is you don't have the capacity to do it, and you aren't really doing all this data gathering currently. So I have a problem with the fiscal impact statement. I really think there would be a fiscal impact based just with personnel needs to perform these services.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I think what that portion of the bill that we were responding to on the fiscal was reporting caseloads and savings, which we already do as part of our overall department rebalance efforts. Tracking people who have actually left the system is a separate issue, and we did not do an analysis or a fiscal impact statement on that because we knew amendments were coming. So
okay. Now, the other possibility here is to, let's take another look at these bills. Let's if you can work together and figure out what you can do and what you can't do, and if there is a fiscal, is that something that the Ways and Means should decide whether or not it's worth doing? That's a judgment that they may feel is worthwhile to help them decide how to allocate the money. So just because it has a fiscal, that doesn't mean that it...
We have to see what's in the bill.
It isn't worthy of the effort, and the Ways and Means Committee might make that decision. So I want to try to refine these, and again, we'll come back and take a look at these three bills, but if you could please get together, and we will, if there needs to be amendments to make it more clear, we will urge...
That's why there's
a legislative council to do it expeditiously. And then we can decide if we want to move one or three of them or none of them or integrate them into a single bill. But we did this during the interim, and I think it did help us make some decisions. So this is kind of similar to that. So other questions, comments? Okay, seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 550, Senate Bill 551, and Senate Bill 552. Okay, we're going to open. There are people here who want to testify on Senate Bill 158. I'm also waiting for a representative. Okay, we'll open a public. Is Grant, Dr. Higginson, in? Oh, is he here? Okay, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 158. We have the.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 158 was originally heard on February 4th. It provides requirements on ambulatory surgical centers and providers and modifies the licensing fees and authorizes alternative procedures for on-site inspections for specific healthcare facilities and in-home health agencies. It requires the Department of Human Services to establish a procedure for filing complaints against home health agencies and in-home care agencies that will ensure the confidentiality of the complainant. Establishes repercussions for retaliation against an employee for notifying authorities of inappropriate care or other violations. It requires the home health agency to follow a treatment plan established and reviewed by a physician or a nurse practitioner. And lastly, it allows the Department of Human Services to assess civil penalties of $1,000 per day of non-compliance or $10,000 for each 30-day period of non-compliance on individuals, health care facilities, home health agencies, and in-home care agencies.
Okay, thank you. Those are, there are three of you who have signed up to testify. Would you come forward, please? Karen, Cameron, Joe Goss. And Francois. Huh? Okay. Frankie. That's easier.
I thought so.
Okay. Would you like to start?
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Koss. I'm here today with Mickey Carrier and Frankie representing Caregiver Connection.
Okay.
Caregiver Connection is a caregiver registry service that operates out of the Portland metropolitan area. And quite honestly, our concern with regards to Senate Bill 158 has not so much to do with what is currently in the bill, but it has to do with what we believe will be amendments proposed to the bill that adds a definition to home care registry that has not yet been considered by the committee. And we just wanted to be here today to talk a little bit about that that definition, should it be presented, and to perhaps offer another version of that definition should it come up. Since it hasn't gone to that level at this point, there's really not a whole lot that we want to talk about, I think, officially at this point.
Well, have you been in touch with Dr. Grant Higginson? Have you been working with him?
Mr. Chair, no, we have not been in touch with Mr. Higginson, but we have had some communication with Ron Prinsloo, who is the director of the Office for Certification and Licensure that has jurisdiction over in-home care agencies, and the discussion has gone around the standpoint that there may be rule created that would apply for or toward registries as well, and we have had communications with him on the subject and expressed our willingness and desire to be part of the process of defining the registry organization and concept and to creating the rule that might govern and regulate those registries. Okay. And at this point, we haven't gone any farther than have the initial conversations.
Okay. Who else wants to testify?
Hi. Thank you for taking a moment to hear what we have to say. I'm Mickey Carrier, and I own Caregiver Connection, which is a caregiver registry model in Portland. I have 120 caregivers on my roster. I've been in business for 10 years. I'm a background as a registered nurse. And to my knowledge, there's only two such registries in the Portland area. And so it may be a case of overreaching at this point in time to come up with legislation regarding registries. But if not, then we are prepared to be involved in the process of writing, helping to write such legislation. So Joe and I have been looking into other state models on this. I've had a lot of legal input over the years as to how to run a registry, and the basic difference between what we do and in-home care agencies do is that we have independent contracting caregivers that we broker for a fee. In-home care agencies employ their caregivers, and there's about 50 of them. And anyway, so that's kind of the nutshell version. We, thinking that we were going to be talking about 158A, which is Ron Prinsloo's amended version that proposes a definition for registries, we came prepared to talk about that with a definition of our own, borrowing from Pennsylvania state rule. And so that's what we're here today to do. Thank you.
Okay.
And I think Mickey expressed everything I need to say. So.
Okay. Well, there is an ongoing group looking at this. And I guess you have to touch bases with them. Dr. Higginson was here earlier. He's not here today because they're not ready yet. So you know who you're supposed to talk with, right?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we are aware of the folks that are involved in the registry and home care agency portion of,
okay.
of 158, and we are attempting to have dialogue with them on the issues that are relevant to our interests, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Seeing no others wishing to testify, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 158. Okay, are we ready for Senate Bill 702? Yeah, well, let's see. Okay, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 702. Arthur Towers. Megan.
Chair Morissette and members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify to you today. For the record, my name is Arthur Towers, political director for Service Employees Union Local 503. Representative Dembro was scheduled to join us, and he's been delayed a few minutes, but we'll proceed without him. Senate Bill 702 is the next step forward for quality home care for vulnerable Oregonians and their caregivers. It brings home care clients and their caregivers in a variety of different programs under the purview of the Home Care Commission. That's already the case for the Client Employed Provider Program, Oregon Project Independence, and the Spousal Care Program. For many years, the state operated its human service programs on the model of low-wage, untrained, pretty invisible women who have in their hearts to provide care. Many of these care providers were treated as non-employees and were totally voiceless. The back of the envelope math puts this as many as 45,000 care providers were, when you add in all the care settings that the state funds. But with your leadership and with the will of the voters, we've partnered to improve the quality of home care for about 14,000 elderly Oregonians and Oregonians with disabilities. You've had face-to-face conversations with many of our members who provide care. These workers now have a face and a voice, and you know that they're committed to quality and they want to have the training and the tools to do the job right. The Home Care Commission has done a very good job with the registry, the training programs, and respite care. And now we need to take the next step forward. This bill would bring existing state programs in compliance with the Oregon Constitution with legislation that you passed in 2001. That would make more clients available for the services the Home Care Commission provides. This bill does not eliminate any existing programs. It does not violate the Staley Agreement, which has been modified a couple of times. Per the Oregon Healthcare Association, this bill and the proposed amendments do not affect private home health agencies. This bill will not break the bank. This bill will give more care providers the right to choose to form a union. We have amendments not yet back from legislative council. And Megan will go over those in just a couple minutes. But we believe we can work with the agency and the commission as we have done over the years to improve quality of care for clients and quality of working conditions for care providers. And again, Senate Bill 702 is another step forward in that direction. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Megan?
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Megan Moyer. I'm with the Service Employee International Union, Local 503. In the group of materials that we've passed out, there is a document titled A Bill for an Act Relating to Home Care Workers. This is what we hope the bill will look like when the Dash 1 amendments are presented and hopefully adopted. So I wanted to use this for this conversation to talk about what our goal for the bill is to be. In Section 1 of this of the full bill, there are a few changes to the definition of a home care worker. The purpose, the first one you will see is in Section 1, Number 6, Letter A, adds under definition of home care worker, it says who is hired directly by an elderly person or a person with disability. We are adding or that person's parent or guardian. To include children receiving in-home services, such as children with developmental disabilities and medically fragile children. Should I stop and let him do it? Go.
Okay.
I'd like to stop and let the representative testify. Thank you.
Welcome, Representative Demarest.
Thank you, Chair Morissette and Senate colleagues. Thank you for accommodating my schedule. I'm Representative Michael Dembro from House District 45, Northeast Portland to Park Rose, and I'm here to present Senate Bill 702 to you. This is the program that would bring additional home care workers into the Home Care Commission program. You may remember that in the year 2000, voters passed Measure 99, which created the Oregon Home Care Commission. The ballot measure language at the time stated that the Home Care Commission, quote, shall ensure that high-quality, comprehensive home care services are provided to the elderly and people with disabilities. Called for a statewide registry of home care providers to which clients and their guardians could look when seeking quality care. Measure 99, which gave home care workers the right to organize, passed by a 63-37% margin. To date, the Home Care Commission model has been a great success, a key part of Oregon's innovative system of home and community caregiving. I've had the opportunity over the last year to meet with a number of workers and clients from my district who are covered currently by the Home Care Commission. These workers are doing very difficult work, and many of them are just one step away from poverty themselves. But I've been very impressed by the level of commitment that these workers have to their clients and the sense of dignity and pride that they take in being part of this group. I'd say that they're proudest of the high level of training that they receive under the commission. This training guarantees that the techniques that they use in helping clients with their activities of daily living will be done correctly. Also, these workers are the frontline monitors, the eyes and ears of the health system with respect to many of our most fragile Oregonians. They help to catch potential problems before these problems become serious, and their clients are very often people with chronic illness, and they're able to help monitor those illnesses. Their training makes the workers aware of these early warning signals and help prevent the need for serious, costly interventions. Not surprisingly, having collective bargaining rights and union representation has also given these workers a sense of common identity and the ability to advocate for their clients, for the needs of their clients. It has greatly helped to stabilize the workforce and reduce turnover. The Home Care Commission program, as it exists today, does have a flaw, however, and this is what Senate Bill 702 is intended to correct. Although Measure 99 was designed to put all home caregivers working with seniors and people with disabilities under the commission, a number of programs that are also funded by the state through DHS have been left out, including Oregonians with developmental disabilities, medically fragile children, and a number of other frail Oregonians. If you look at the chart which I assume was given. Has that chart been given yet?
It should have been bill filed.
Yeah. Listing the various state home care programs, you'll see which programs have been able to benefit from the commission process and which have been left out. Senate Bill 702 will not end in any of these existing programs, but rather it will offer all programs the advantages of the commission and help them to work more effectively. Senate Bill 702 brings all home care programs into compliance with the original intent of Measure 99. It gives all providers access to commission-run training programs and potentially to collective bargaining rights if they so choose. It moves us closer to one of the key goals of health care reform, creating an integrated, high-quality home care system providing all clients with access to quality, trained care providers. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay. Questions? Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, Megan,
back
you
to
were...
the technicalities.
Again, for the record, Megan Moyer with the Service Employee International Union. And I will be brief in my summary and happy to answer any questions. Again, Section 1 of the amended bill would clarify putting Oregon's home care programs under the Home Care Commission, laying out the groups that currently, and I hope that you all have that chart in your bill file, laying out those programs that are currently not under the Home Care Commission and bringing them under the Home Care Commission.
We don't have that chart.
No, we do.
Yeah, we do.
Where is it?
And I can make that. I apologize. I can also make that available.
I don't have it.
We don't have it.
No.
It's emailed to me.
Yeah. Should I read the program?
Yeah, you have to get it to the...
Yeah, we can have it for the record.
To our...
Okay, very quickly, the programs that currently are under the Home Care Commission are Client Employee Provider Program, Oregon Project Independence, and the Spousal Care Program. The programs that we intend to put under this, due to this language in Section 1, is the Independent Choices Program, Personal Care Services, Children's Intensive In-Home Services, Family Support Services for Children with Developmental Disabilities, Comprehensive In-Home Support for Adults with Developmental Disabilities, Support Services for Adults with Developmental Disabilities, Medically Fragile Children's Services, and Medically Involved Children's Program.
Okay. Sure.
Yeah.
Are those programs prohibited currently from being in under the commission?
Senator Morissette, Senator Cruz, those programs currently are not prohibited, but they're not currently under the purview of the Home Care Commission.
Follow-up. But if they chose to be, they could be?
It's... Megan, I don't know if you can answer that, but Senator Morissette, Senator Cruz, I feel like they've been set up not to be under the commission. I'm not sure whose decision it is to put them under the commission. They aren't under the commission. It feels like the wording from the constitutional amendment is pretty clear. They should be under the commission. Felt like the best way to get them under the commission was to add clarity to the statute.
The programs that pertain to children and adults with developmental disabilities and medically fragile children currently aren't, because in rule the department has defined the Home Care Commission as serving seniors and people with physical disabilities. I'm not 100% sure why the Independent Choices Program. I think that the language changing funding and paid will hopefully rectify that situation, but in rule is where the limitations have been.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. I would like to hear from these programs that we're going to require to be under the commission with this bill as to whether they would like to be. You know, mm-hmm. I think it's reasonable.
Well, okay, that is reasonable to hear their wishes, but it's also reasonable to do what is best for the clients and the state. And so, what, you know, I can understand where one or two of those commissions say, no, we don't want to be in, or those groups may not want to be in the commission. So we would, yeah, definitely we want to hear from them. Okay, Megan, did you have anything else?
Yeah, very briefly, Section 2 would expand the registry that currently exists within the Home Care Commission so that clients would be able to find an array of qualified providers based on program type. And then Section 3 and 4, again, are modifying the definition of a home care worker from paid by the state, county, or area agency on aging to funded by. So the same Section 3 and 4 have the same purpose.
Okay. Thank you. Yes. Yes. Senator Mona Sanders.
Thank you. I would like to know what the average pay is for those under the commission and what is the average pay for those that are not under the commission. I think that might be an extremely important factor. And can you shed some light regarding how people are paid under these groups that are not under the commission and those that are?
Chair Morse, Senator Miners Anderson, we'll have other witnesses come up and talk about that in particular, so they're a little bit better equipped to answer that than I am. Megan, do you have a direct answer? But it's the home care clients who are under a union contract, which would be the ones under the commission, earn the top end, I believe, between $10 and $11 an hour. They also have access to health insurance for themselves and for their children. They have paid time off for training, and they're covered by workers' compensation coverage.
And those that are not, then, are not paid the same, do not have benefits?
Chair Moore said, Senator Montes Henderson, that's my understanding.
My name is Megan Moyer. Yes, Chair Moore, Senate members of the committee, our current home care contract is $10.20 an hour for hourly workers. It is less if you're a 24-hour care provider. The pay is not exactly the same for every other home care program. I know that one of our witnesses today works for a brokerage that serves adults with developmental disabilities and makes an hourly wage of $10.21 an hour. But there is a level of variance.
Okay.
It would be nice
we're
to have that comparison
we're
in writing.
Hear some other people. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Point of clarification: you said that those that are covered get workers' comp. Don't all employees aren't all employees covered with workers' comp, whether they belong to the union or not?
Our members are employees for the purposes of collective bargaining of the Home Care Commission. Otherwise, they are not employees. This is true for most of the client employee programs, including the brokerage DD. They are not employed by the brokerage. They are de facto independent contractors. And some brokerages, to my understanding, have helped with workers' compensation coverage, but no, that is not a guarantee for any of these workers.
Yes. So these are independent contractors, not employees, that we're looking at including them into the ability to belong to the union. They're independent contractors right now. They're not employees.
Chair Morris, Senator Telfer, the history of this is that for many years, all in-home care providers were classified as independent contractors under the home care rules. The voters changed that with Measure 99 in 2000 when they changed the Constitution to say that for the purposes of collective bargaining, these workers should be covered by the Home Care Commission as employees, again, for the purpose of collective bargaining. Then in the 2005 legislative session, 2007 legislative session, the legislature said that workers covered by the Home Care Commission would be also receive workers' compensation. So that's when it came into statute, was in 2007. But these other workers are not covered by the Home Care Commission, and so their status regarding workers' compensation coverage is still sketchy.
Because they're independent contractors.
Okay, we have others wishing to testify.
Independent contractors.
So, okay, Aaron Smith, Bill Lynch, and Megan Gray, would you please come up? And then James Taves will come up and enlighten us after your testimony. Okay, who would like to start? Okay, go ahead and identify yourself, please.
Good morning, Chair Morissette, members of the committee. My name is Erin Smith, and I am a home care worker who loves her job because it helps to keep me humble and makes me appreciate the great need for compassion and loving care that clients deserve. It makes me feel like I am helping change the attitudes of people about how we treat and care for our disabled brothers and sisters. I currently work for a developmentally disabled gentleman. Every day I help him to get showered, dressed, and fed in the mornings to start his day. I make and take him to all appointments. I also manage his medications and make sure that he takes the correct amount at the same time every day. I also mentor him and help him to make good decisions. I do all his washing, cooking, and other everyday things that we all take for granted. I enjoy doing fun things with him, especially new things like catching snakes, flying kites. He has now become a member of a community center with my help. The fear of swimming has gone away and now can go down the slide 50 times in one swim session. Fishing has also become an activity he enjoys. I would hate to think what he would do without me. His care is funded through the Staley Agreement and is handled through a brokerage. I believe all brokerage home care workers should be allowed to join a union and fall under the Home Care Commission. It would greatly improve the quality of care for our clients. Being under the Home Care Commission would mean the home care workers would have access to training classes given by the Home Care Commission. I was fortunate enough to have a temporary county-funded senior client this last year, which allowed me to join SEIU Local 503. I took advantage of all training classes, which has improved the quality of care that I provide for my brokerage client as well as my senior client. The classes that were most beneficial to me were challenging behaviors due to the fact he can be difficult at times. This class taught me several different approaches to deal with this, which has decreased the level of frustration for my client and myself. I find the bathing and grooming a beneficial class due to it was a struggle for years to get him to do this. Now I have almost no trouble with that aspect of his care. Another class was to teach me to completely be prepared in case of any type of emergency. This might seem like an easy task, but there was a lot that would have been overlooked without this class. Under the Home Care Commission, I also have access to mentors, which are there to answer questions or help guide them through difficulties experienced with the job of a home care worker. I personally had to go to my mentor with a problem I experienced with my county client in regards to his misusing his payment. I have been working with my brokerage client for 3 years and truly wish I would have had the training and mentors at my disposal when I started. It would have made 100% difference in the care that I provide. For example, the fear of showers and water was so great that we would both be in tears by the end of the bathing and he would not be clean. And it would add to his mental anxieties. Being prepared for emergencies of all kinds has changed all procedures in my household where my client lives. And now we both are confident that any emergency will be handled properly. My client has also learned a lot of the techniques taught in this class and has enriched his thinking and preparedness of all situations. I plead with you to pass Bill 702 for the benefit of quality care for all clients. Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about the, without a lot of detail, the misuse of pain meds that your client, how did you deal with that?
I went to my mentor. I'm not allowed to give clients' names out.
No,
and
of course
just
not.
Gave the situation to her and what was going on in the household. She told me what measures to take by going to the caseworker and taking myself off this person's as a caregiver so my state number does not get revoked if and when something bad happens. He was overdosing himself and selling his drugs to people off the street for money.
And you went to your mentor.
I went to my mentor for advice.
Helped you.
And she told me to go to the caseworker and to resign immediately, which I did. And I went to the caseworker and gave my journal. I keep a journal every day and turned it in. What they do with it is what they do.
Okay.
And one more thing about the pay. The pay is the same with the brokerage and with the home care commission. I make a penny more with the brokerage, but I have no insurance. I have no classes. I have no benefits. I have no workers' comp. I have absolutely nothing. They are just a connection to really nothing, paperwork.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, my name is Reagan Gray, and I'm policy analyst for Children First for Oregon. I'd like to thank, I would like to express our support for the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 702. Children First for Oregon's mission is to make Oregon a place where all children thrive. Some of Oregon's most vulnerable children are in home care programs that are not under the purview of the Home Care Commission. Through the Dash 1 amendments, we can provide better quality home care services for these vulnerable children. The Home Care Commission works to improve the quality of home care in Oregon. The Commission has developed strong home care programs that provide training for care providers, provide clients and members access to a registry of home care workers, and provide better access to respite care. However, Oregonians with developmental disabilities, medically fragile children, and other frail Oregonians are left out. These Oregonians are receiving care from programs with minimal oversight and from workers that are less likely to have received advanced training. By adopting the Dash 1 amendments, we will bring these home care programs under the Home Care Commission and provide quality care to vulnerable Oregonians. Thank you.
Questions?
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, my name is Bill Lynch, and I'm the director of the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities. It's a governor-appointed council that carries a federal mandate to both advise state government and to advocate in coordination with people with developmental disabilities and their families. I've only had a brief opportunity to hear about the amendments to this bill, and I probably won't be able to speak to any of the technical aspects, but I do have two major concerns. And the first one is we're talking about programs and systems of services for people with developmental disabilities, many of which are capped services, and we have very grave concerns that that the buying power of people with developmental disabilities and their families would be significantly reduced. I should have prefaced all of my remarks by saying we have a strong commitment also to decent wages, benefits, and training for everyone that provides services and supports to people with developmental disabilities. And we have a track record of working hard in this legislative body and elsewhere to try to get those benefits, wages, and training opportunities up to a level that people that do this very difficult work deserve. But like I said, we do have a concern that moving in this direction in this way would have the potential to reduce the buying power of people that get flexible dollars to direct their own care, hire the people they want to hire, access training and wages in the same fashion. And we're just concerned that that could have a very detrimental effect on the amount of services and supports that people would be able to purchase through some of these CAP programs, like you've been hearing this daily agreement, mandated support services for adults, plus medically fragile program, medically involved program for kids. We've got the personal care 20 program and family support, another one. So there's a real concern about that. My second concern is that it would potentially undermine the kind of the underpinnings of developmental disability services that we've worked hard to build over the years, and that is kind of the philosophy and values behind those services of self-determination, choice, and control on the part of people that receive the services. As many of you probably know, in the past we had a very limited menu of services for people. If they had access to services at all, it was you can have A, B, or none of the above. And now we have a system that is much more based on a philosophy of self-determination, really sitting down with the individual and the family and exploring what their needs are and how they would like those needs addressed. So there's a concern on that level too. I just wanted to conclude by saying that we also work across disability with lots of other disability agencies and organizations in the work we do as a Developmental Disabilities Advisory Council. And while I happen to be chair of the Oregon Disabilities Commission, I'm not here speaking in that capacity today, but I would say that we would have some of the same concerns about the Independent Choices Program and the impact that this could have on that program and its philosophy of self-directed services.
Okay, having said all that, you're neutral, right?
That's right, and I'm neutral, and that's why I really wanted to emphasize my opening comment, which is we are committed to wages, salaries, benefits for people. We want quality care for people. And we're also not an agency. We're part of the Department of Human Services, even though we're federally funded and federally mandated. So we don't take direct positions, but we do advise on the impact of things that come before you.
Thank you. Questions?
I have a question. Yes. And maybe this might be a question more for Megan, on how many family members would fall under this? Of all of the people who give care, are there family members? And are they a part of, family members, are they a part of who you cover too?
Chair Morissette, member of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Megan Moyer. We do not have numbers on the number of family members who provide care. There is nothing that prohibits family members from being care providers as long as they are deemed appropriate and pass a criminal background check. We do have many family members who are members of our home care union. There are family members in the Independent Choices Program, as well as many of the others. There are less family members in some of the respite care type home care programs because the purpose is to give parents or guardians a break, so you'll see less family members being the care providers in those settings, but in spousal care, they're exclusively family members. But you'll see in almost every program, family members are an option. And in no way has unionization or the Home Care Commission limited choice for a client. If you wish to have a spouse, a relative, a neighbor be your provider, you're able to do that. It is a client-employer relationship in all these programs. You could have a perfectly well-qualified worker. If it's not an appropriate fit for you, you are at will to decide to not have them anymore and select somebody else. Nothing in the Home Care Commission or unionization at any point limits the client's choice of their provider. That is a core principle of home care, and in no way would change or has changed with the current people under the Home Care Commission.
But but you don't know how many are family and how many are not.
We don't have the list of people in these other programs, so there's no way for us to know.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Joyce Willman.
Good morning. I was asked to come speak today because I have a unique position in this whole issue.
Give your name.
Oh, I'm sorry. Joy Willman, J-O-Y-E.
Yeah.
Willman.
Okay.
You see, I'm one of the original home care workers that helped get ballot measure 99 underway, and I stood at Fred Meyer's and collected petition signing and everything. And I also helped get House Bill 3816 passed, which is the one that actually put the Home Care Commission into the Constitution. And I'm also very familiar with the Staley lawsuit and the state brokerages. In fact, I still work as a home care worker, but I'm also employed by one of the brokerages. In fact, in the last few years, I've worked for three of the brokerages and Community Vision, which is also a similar agency. When we first started with the the home care union and the training registry ideas were just coming up. The brokerages weren't created yet. The Staley lawsuit was in court system at the time. In fact, during that time, people with developmental disabilities were still in the state client-employed provider program, which is the home care program. Right after we bargained our first contract, the brokerages were created on and the state started moving people with developmental disabilities into the brokerages. These people were enjoying the same type of care as everyone on the CEP program now. They didn't ask to be moved, and they didn't have any say in the decision. In some cases, the clients lost their long-standing home care worker because the workers didn't want to leave the program they were already working in. I have been told that the definition of developmental disability is a diagnosis of a disability that happened before adulthood and will not improve in their lifetime. That is why children with developmental disabilities should also be included in this bill. There are at least 11 home care programs ran by the state, and only 3 of them are in compliance, as Megan stated earlier. That leaves approximately 9,000 or more other clients who are being denied access to good quality trained caregivers through the registry and the trainings. I know the types of people who do these jobs. I'm one of them. Usually they're good at what they do, but could benefit themselves and their clients by getting further education and training, especially the parents who care for their children who have been diagnosed with a disability. The only training some of them have is by what the hospital nurses told them to do for the child as they were leaving the hospital. But they have nowhere to further their training or to find respite workers if they need any kind of a break. As a caregiver through the brokerage, I see where these trainings could help, and I even see how some new training could help both the people with developmental disabilities and our home care workers. And I just want to stop real quick and tell you I have a lady at my church who is also a home care worker, and she's constantly complaining that the respite workers don't know how to use the Hoyer lift that lifts people when they fall or out of bed or out of a chair. And so to have a Hoyer lift training would be perfect for both home care workers, respite workers, and the brokerages. Like information and training on how to use a Hoyer lift properly, these trainings would not be exclusive and can help all who feel the training would help them. Please amend Senate Bill 702 to bring all home care programs into compliance with state law and the Oregon Constitution. And in many of the different agencies, the salaries that I get are different salaries. They roughly range in the $10 area. One agency I get paid $9.25. For the state I get $10.25. And for another agency I get $12 an hour. So the brokerages have a sliding scale on what the client can, what their income is as to what they get paid.
Okay. Questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
James Taves, would you come up, please, and speak to this important issue?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, James Taves from the Department of Human Services Senior and Disabilities Program. Hands-on care for seniors and people with disabilities is probably some of the most important work that we do and that the department does. I spent the first 5 years of my career providing direct services, and I have a very long memory of the challenges that go with this kind of care, and have known throughout my entire career how often we undervalue and underpay people who do very, very challenging work. And I think everybody's intent around this issue is to improve both the quality and the compensation for people who do this very important work. This bill presents lots of challenges, however. It crosses many statutes, different groups, different payment systems, different federal waivers. So it's not a simple issue or a simple fix. When Measure 99 passed, we worked very hard with the union and others in creating the Home Care Commission and implementing the enabling legislation, which was added to Chapter 410. Chapter 410 is the enabling legislation for seniors and people with physical disabilities. And in fact, if you go to the definitions of home care services in that statute, It's all services that aid people with their activities of daily living in their own homes. Developmental disability services, mental health services, some of these other programs have other enabling statutes with very different definitions of the type of services that are provided. So some of the definitions by their very nature in 410 are problematic for some of the other populations that the amendments attempt to bring into the purview of the home care program. There's other complications as well. For example, in Chapter 410, the definition of a person with a disability is based on their SSI eligibility. In Chapter 427 and others, and I don't want to get too technical here, it's not based on that. Probably half of all people with developmental disabilities are not eligible for SSI because they get Social Security based on their parents' records. So you have, again, different eligibility and standards for these different populations. If you look at potentially the different programs that would be brought into the purview of the Home Care Commission, and I think others have listed those, family support, developmental disability, comprehensive in-home care, medically fragile kids, medically involved waivers, independent choices, personal care 20, most of those are a mix and match of staff support plus goods and services and other equipment and things of that. So it's typically a package within a constrained or a limited or a capped benefit amount in which the family then or the individual with a developmental disability or some of these other conditions can pick and mix and match a set of services. So it's not just in-home services. And in fact, under Staley, for example, that was mentioned, in many cases people are purchasing employment, community inclusion, other community activities that are outside the purview of the home and fall outside of the definition of home care services. So that's an important fact. It's not simply in-home services provided by a staff person, but it's a whole range of different goods and services that are purchased. In most cases, and this, the point came up before, these are not independent contractors and never really have been. They have classically been considered as domestic employees under state and federal law, and domestic employees have typically been excluded from workers' compensation and some of those other benefits. In Measure 99, for the Home Care Commission, for the senior and physical disability population, we explicitly went in to redefine them for purposes of their collective bargaining rights and the benefit packages that would then be used. These programs cover, as I mentioned, a lot of different federal waivers and different payment systems through counties, through brokerages. In the Staley Agreement, for example, which is a legal settlement, which we settled in federal court, the services and supports, the counseling, the cash, all goes through brokerages that were created with consumer-directed boards as part of that settled agreement and what we then reflected in our waivers with the federal government. The total dollar amount is capped, so families and individuals have to choose within that capped amount what they're going to purchase. And I think one of the concerns we have is if we're going to push out benefits for workers, which is a great thing, and it exceeds that capped amount, either we then decrease significantly the purchasing power of individuals and families, or we'd have to find a different way to account for those other benefits beyond those capped amounts.
Have we completely settled the Staley Agreement? Has the state of Oregon done, have we provided the compensation that we were supposed to? Where are we with the Staley Agreement?
Mr. Chairman, the Staley Agreement was, the Staley Settlement was signed in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
In it, we made a commitment and signed an agreement in federal court that over a period of 6 years, we would fully roll out what we called support services. So these are non-24-hour services to individuals often living at home with their families or aging parents and caregivers. To date, we've enrolled, I think, almost 5,000 individuals. We're scheduled by the end of this biennium, June 30th, to have completed that enrollment. It exceeded the original time period because during the 2003 budget reductions, we renegotiated with the plaintiffs, extending the life of the settlement out until the end of 2011, but however saying that as of the end of this biennium, everyone that was eligible had to at least gotten the first round of services anticipated under that agreement. So, Mr. Chairman, yes, we are on schedule to comply and to complete that agreement.
Does that have anything to do with the resources available that you say will not allow them to get all of the services that they need then?
Mr. Chairman, on the well, again, these programs are very different. If you look at the senior and physical disability program under the purview of the Home Care Commission, the benefits that are that a person with a disability under that program or an elderly person, they are assessed against their needs for activities of daily living, bathing, toileting, dressing, mobility, and all of those things. The assessment tool used there determines the number of hours for which they are eligible. The payment of those hours and the workers and the workers' comp and health insurance and all the other things that go with that are not within any kind of dollar cap that those consumers have to worry about. In the Staley settlement, in family support, and in much of the rest of the developmental disability programs, however, there are tight dollar caps. In Staley, for example, the cap is $800 per month per person based on acuity of other needs that can go up to about $1,600 a month. That's both in the legal agreement and in the federal waiver. So I think part of the concern expressed by Mr. Lynch and certainly being expressed by myself is if we look at other benefits and accruing to the workers and it has to occur within a tight dollar cap, then simply we're going to erode the purchasing power of consumers. So that would have to be addressed, and it would also potentially have a significant budget impact for us as well.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at is the fact that we have not completely compensated in the Staley agreement. Now, do we have the money to do it at the end of this biennium by June 3rd? And my question is, does that impact the types of services that people are going to receive if we fully fund? Now, you mentioned 11. Are you saying that our obligation will be completely fulfilled at the end of this current biennium?
Mr. Chairman, our obligations in terms of the rollout of eligible persons is scheduled to be completed by the end of this biennium, and yes, the dollars for that are still in our budget. In the budget, but the agreement goes beyond the actual rollout period. In the budget for this next biennium, even in the governor's recommended budget with all of the significant reductions that the legislature will have to look at, the continuation of the Staley agreement for everybody currently served as well as additional people coming on is still within even those lower numbers in the governor's recommended budget. We've cut the caseload very tightly, and we're very concerned that if we exceed it, then of course we could be in trouble with the legal agreement. But yes, it is continued in the budget.
Senator Montesanderson.
I'm going to go back to when you say this is going to affect purchasing power. So if this bill is passed and we have a family who wants services, and I just don't quite understand this, that means that they would have to pay the benefits, insurance, workers' comp, all of that has to be in the purchasing power for the services that they want. I just need to get my hands on this thing, because insurance alone can be what, $300-$500 a month. If you have a cap of $800, the services will be anyway. I just need to understand this a little bit better,
Mr. Chairman. Senator Montesanderson, If this bill passed, we would have to take a look at all kinds of things, because obviously living within a dollar cap in which you're expanding benefits for the workers against a cap for the person with a disability or the family would not be workable at all. In my mind, we would have to significantly break that budget cap or deal with that cap in a different manner than currently under the legal settlement and the way we've done the waivers with the federal government. We would simply have to, because otherwise individuals and their families would lose. And I don't think anybody that's been at this table today would wish that. But nonetheless, then our dilemma becomes under our federal waivers, because again, we have a whole series of different payment systems. So if we maintain some kind of cap, build Medicaid within that cap, but we're also attempting to cover Medicaid for increased benefits and workers' compensation, et cetera, in the worker part of that package, all of the Medicaid costs ultimately have to be tracked back to the individual. And at this point, I mean, we just saw the amendments on Friday. We haven't even begun to envision how you could potentially do that. The IT issues for us would probably be quite extraordinary, because you're weaving together different payment systems and contracting mechanisms and then billing the federal government. So I can't even begin to detail what that might mean at this point in time. But right now, anything that goes to support that individual and the family, for example, in the Staley agreement, is under a tight dollar cap. So that would have to be dealt with in a pretty forthright manner. In my mind, the one last point I wanted to make was about independent choices, which has been mentioned. Independent choices actually preceded even Measure 99. It was originally what was called technically 1115 waiver from the federal government, and then it was turned into a new state plan option that Congress authorized in 2005. It is essentially a cash and counseling program. So I think we have less than 200 people with disabilities that access that program. In that scenario, they actually choose to be cashed out. So we do the assessment, the number of hours or whatever they would otherwise be eligible for, and then we actually give them the cash, and they purchase all of their own supports within an overall list of authorized services. So if we were to include them, we would have to go back, talk about an authorized number of in-home hours that would be eligible to them under the home care program, but it wouldn't be cash and counseling. For all practical purposes, we would need them to terminate that federal waiver as it's currently constructed and the choice that those particular consumers have in that program. Let me conclude there. I mean, it's a complex issue, and I hope I didn't get too technical here, but I mean, there's a lot of considerations that go beyond a simple redefinition of who a home care worker is.
Okay. Thank you. Further questions? Megan, would you come up? You can just stay.
Sure.
I'd like to clarify the intent of the bill, because I think there seems to be some confusion. Under Senate Bill 702, with the amendment, none of these new programs that would be under the Home Care Commission would have the same contract as the current home care worker. So I think saying this is the roll-up cost and this is how it's going to impact client purchasing power, you can't really have that conversation, because each of these program groups would have the right to collective bargaining. That does not mean that they would choose to utilize that right. If they did choose to do that, there is a negotiating process, of which can be lengthy, and would be done in accordance to the program and its funding stream. So I definitely appreciate what James is saying, but I think that there's a little confusion about how this would work, because each program would need to go through its own process, because he is correct. They are different. They do fund differently. Their definitions are different. So I did want to clarify that. I also wanted to clarify that Oregon is not the only state with an independent choices, or as it's called nationally, a cash and counseling model. In fact, both the states of Washington and California, our neighbors, have cash and counseling, and those workers are currently covered under the SEIU home care bargaining contract. So
I don't think we're doing something radically different or even revolutionary. This is existing in both Washington and California and has enabled those programs to exist and continue.
Senator Telfer.
Thank you. So a point of clarification. We've heard testimony from people who are currently independent contractors, so to speak, under brokerages, who are not getting benefits. They want to get benefits. So to be brought under the commission in order to get benefits, they have to belong to the union to get to, in order to get those benefits?
No.
But so, follow up. So yes. If they don't have to be part of the union, but they still want these benefits, somebody's going to pay for these costs.
What the way Oregon, our current contract works, you do not have to be a member of the union. You are, if you choose not to sign up, you can be what's called fair share. The choice to form a union is a choice that goes through a collective bargaining process, so you have to get majority workers to sign up. So there is a process where the majority of workers need to indicate, yes, we wish to have a union. I think if they choose to do so, they begin collectively bargaining with the state. Now, it is the hope of many workers in forming a union to improve their circumstances, what they would bargain for, what those benefits would look like, how they would be implemented, is entirely a subject of collective bargaining. So I can't say X worker will get this benefit package or won't get this benefit package. That's a process of collective bargaining.
Will this have a fiscal as written?
Mr. Chairman, we haven't done that analysis yet. Again, we just saw the amendments on Friday. So, I mean, I think we need to think that through.
Yeah.
I think Megan is absolutely right. If you look at collective bargaining, it's probably something that's prospective. On the other hand, we have a history now with the home care worker, what we think workers want, how third-party arrangements on health care insurance and workers' compensation has worked. When you come under the purview of the Home Care Commission can elect to cover these different groups as part of the collective bargaining agreement still. So it's our belief that, and I believe in universal health care, so I mean, why wouldn't anyone want to access health insurance if they possibly can? So how those costs would be set up or constructed with all these different payments and contracts, I don't know at this point in time, and I think that partly is a subject of collective bargaining. I do think, and again, it's premature, that to really look at a group in collective bargaining, you need a uniform data system. Under the Home Care Commission, we have a uniform payment system where you can do deductions, where you can enroll people in third-party benefits. Again, we have all these different payment streams, and if you begin to move that all together, it's certainly going to pose some major challenges on the IT side for the department. I can't even begin to envision exactly what that cost might be, but those are all the things I think we're going to have to think through in terms of the fiscal impact either in this biennium or in upcoming biennium.
Well, it would depend on collective bargaining.
Mr. Chairman, in part, but by the very nature of collective bargaining in terms of the impact on certainly some of the systems we would have to put together and the notion of what you can even bargain if you're still dealing with capped payment systems, again, we've just begun thinking about this.
If this bill passed, at what point would there be a fiscal? You would wait until those people who came under the cap made some or wanted to bargain, right?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know.
Oh.
I simply don't know at this point because, again, we've just started analyzing this. I can't even begin to say.
Well, I guess my question is there a collective, is there a fiscal, do you think there would be a fiscal impact on this piece of legislation for next biennium?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think the bill has an emergency clause, so it would probably take effect in January 1st of 2010. My assumption is whichever groups would then want to organize, Megan, you could probably speak better to this than I, we'd be at the table sometime. So we'd definitely be at the table yet this biennium, whether that rolled out as a series of additional costs or wages and benefits at this point, we can always speculate.
Okay.
I would like to add, Chair Morissette, members of the committee again, Megan Moyer for the record. I would like to add that in the 2007 legislative session, two bills passed through the legislature, one regarding granting collective bargaining rights to child care providers, the other regarding collective bargaining rights for adult foster care providers. Neither of those bills had fiscal impact statements.
If it has a fiscal, though, it would have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, which probably in this economic climate would be significant.
Yeah, if it had a fiscal. Yes.
But if it doesn't have a fiscal, then the cost would be passed on to the patient, so to speak. I mean, if somebody's picking up the tab for these benefits that we've heard today, so if
the benefits wouldn't take place until they were collected, they were bargained. They're not automatic, right?
But it's still going to cost money. Yeah.
Yeah,
Chair Morissette,
it's going to cost somebody.
Senator Taffer.
Yeah, well, okay, but
our child care workers don't have health insurance.
Excuse me.
Sorry.
We're going to either increase the cap above 800, so therefore the so-called patient would be paying it, or the state's going to pick up the gap.
At what point?
Again, that would only happen after a contract was ratified, which is a lengthy process. And there's an effective date for many things, which is also a subject of collective bargaining. Could be this biennium. I actually sincerely doubt it would be this biennium. Those are all subjects of collective bargaining.
These concerns were stated in the original collective bargaining bill, that all of these things are going to happen. And they did at some point. But it's a collective bargaining. And having been a negotiator for a union, nothing is for sure. You bargain. You sit down and you go back and forth, and you can only bargain within the parameters of reality. And sometimes you win, sometimes you lose, but that's what it's about. Yes.
Mr. Chair, I would suggest that in the last major collective bargaining agreement arrived at by the governor, he spent $1 billion we knew we didn't have. So reality doesn't necessarily come into play.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I want to make a broader statement again regarding care workers, home care workers. To me, they are vital to the system, and they actually do so much preventative care. They keep our so many people out of institutions, out of hospitals, et cetera. So I still want to make that point that they are a part of the big picture, and that includes in healthcare reform. And if we're really going to do healthcare reform, we are focusing on preventative care. So I still wish there was a nexus between this and overall healthcare reform. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions, comments? Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 702. Other business before the committee? Seeing none, we will adjourn.